Welcome, everyone. I'm Dennis Menick, president of Sharp, and I'm here to simply introduce our two speakers for tonight, two people that are uniquely qualified on the subject matter, both Sharp members. Joel DeBettencourt is the outreach officer for Nonviolent Peace Force, which is a nonprofit working in conflict zones to save lives. Gilda is a UC Berkeley graduate and a member of the Meta Center for Nonviolence. Many of you probably know Frank Noto. Frank's a longtime Sharp member and board member. Frank is a West Point graduate, former Army officer, Commonwealth Club Foreign Affairs Committee member, and amateur military historian. I'm going to simply turn the meeting over to Frank.
Well, thank you, Dennis. I appreciate it. I also want to acknowledge Sophia Perel, who did all the logistics and is doing all the logistics and making this possible. She's a social media expert and is also vice president of Sharp. I really don't claim to be uniquely qualified to speak on this. I really am not an expert, even though I did serve in the Army for 14 years. I never served in combat or in Afghanistan. I think I know something about this subject, but some of you may know more. I could be wrong, and some of you may be right. So both Gilda and I are very passionate about Afghanistan, so we decided to share some of our thoughts here with you tonight, and I hope you'll indulge us. Our format for this evening is going to be a little different than what you've seen before. After Gilda and I share some thoughts briefly, we're going to turn it over to you and let you ask some questions. And for those questions, please limit yourself to 1 minute to ask the question. And then that way we can hear from everybody. Then we're going to move to the public forum section of this evening. And we're going to, it's going to be open mic. You get to ask, you get to say anything you want. You can make your own speeches. We'd ask you to keep them to 3 minutes so we can allow everyone to talk. We may or may not respond to your speeches, but our hope is that everyone will get a turn. Okay, Gilda, take it away.
Hello, everyone. I'm your neighbor on 9th and Judah. My name is Gilda Betancourt, and I really appreciated what Frank said. I do not consider myself an expert on Afghanistan, but it is a country that I really care about. I care about, obviously, all people in all countries. But Afghanistan, well, I'm originally from Fremont. Even though I've been living on 9th and Judah since 1994, Fremont is actually the home of the largest Afghan community outside of Afghanistan. And there are many more other folks of the community in other parts of the Bay Area. The Bay Area probably has one of the largest, well, it does. It has the largest community of folks outside of Afghanistan. So in a way, a lot of these folks are our neighbors. We're going to be seeing a lot of challenges and struggle for folks who are trying to get their family members, their friends, out of harm's way to a safer place. I'm going to try to keep what I'm sharing with you really brief, because I'd rather just try to do our best, Frank and I, to answer your questions. Maybe together as a group, we could come up with some ideas or even more interesting questions. The reason I was asked to speak is for the last 20 years, I've worked with an organization called Nonviolent Peace Force. And its name, even though it's quite a mouthful, is exactly what it claims to be. It is a peace force, which is even a term that the military uses, a peacekeeping force. But we focus on using nonviolent or unarmed means to protect civilians, to prevent violence, and to try and promote peace. And we're an international organization. So currently right now we have programs in, you know, very challenging places as well, like South Sudan, Iraq, Myanmar, the Mindanao region of the Philippines. And last year we started a program in Minnesota, in the United States, and hoping to expand to other areas. And what we focus on is actually working with grassroots and with people, civilian to civilian work, because we believe that that's actually where lasting peace stays. And I think Afghanistan is probably a really good example that not everything has a military solution, or that military solutions aren't enough alone. Without you know, including civilians and working with them, you're not going to get the result you want. So I'm going to stick to the title of our program. What happened in Afghanistan? What can we expect? What can we do about it? What happened in Afghanistan? Basically, 20 years, our country was attacked, and very understandably, as a nation, folks felt they needed to respond in a way to make sure that that attack would never happen again. But in those 20 years, a lot of things changed. We started fighting even in a different country, not Afghanistan. So our focus on Afghanistan was really quick, but then it went away. And I'm afraid, actually, that the same might happen now. Like, we're all paying attention to Afghanistan, and I'm wondering how many people are still going to be paying attention to Afghanistan a year from now. And that's why I highly recommend following the progress of what the Afghan diaspora in the Bay Area are doing, because they are going to stay focused on what's going on in Afghanistan, and perhaps they can make suggestions. They are our fellow Americans in many cases, and they have a deeper understanding of the culture and of people. So what's going to happen in Afghanistan? I did not bring my crystal ball, and I do not think such a thing exists. But there's a lot of folks who are believing that, you know, oh, maybe the Taliban are better now. They're different. It's true. The Taliban of this now are not the Taliban of 20 years ago. But in a way, they really could be much worse. And there are definitely even worse actors who might become involved in what's going on in Afghanistan. So I think we really need to stand by the Afghan people, particularly the women and children, but all of them, really. It's going to be quite a mess, and I only expect it to get worse. From what I've seen of past conflicts, I don't know. What we can do about it, I guess I'm recommending that you stay close and follow what the Afghan diaspora are suggesting, because these are people who will not lose sight of that country, for sure. I attended a virtual town hall that was hosted by the World Affairs Council, where a lot of these mostly young people came to talk about how people today can help folks who want to flee Afghanistan. Right now, they're all focused on just getting as many people out of that country as possible, or if they happen to be now in the United States or another part of the world, keeping them from having to go back to Afghanistan. And we'll be sharing a list of those folks. I will also send you a recording of that town hall, and also a announcement that Nonviolent Peace Force made with recommendations that people can do about Afghanistan. I think that's probably what I want to share most with you now. Like I said, I wanted to keep my talking down to a minimum so I could try to focus a little bit more on your questions. But I really appreciate that you took time tonight to care for a place that seems like, you know, it is literally on the other end of the world, but the world is shrinking, and the suffering of one people is, it spills all over the world. And an unstable Afghanistan is a concern for the entire world, actually not the United States. So I can explain that a little bit more if you'd like me to, but right now I'm just going to allow others to speak so we can dive into questions. Thank you.
Very well said, Jordan. So I'm going to start off by pointing out some myths about the war in Afghanistan, in my opinion. Some of these are half-truths. The first one is the United States lost the war. We didn't lose. We quit. There is a difference. The American military lost zero battles. We probably won 98% of the skirmishes, but there was a definite cost. First, President Trump and then President Biden decided to get out for essentially political reasons, campaign promises. A second myth is that the Afghan military is to blame. President Biden said, American troops cannot and should not be fighting and dying in a war that Afghan forces, by and large, are not willing to fight and die in themselves. While I'm a big fan of President Biden generally, he's wrong on this. Afghans have sacrificed a lot for their country. More than 66,000 Afghan soldiers and police have already died in the war, and that was before August. It's kind of hard to blame those people when they gave their lives for their country. The Afghan army collapsed for complicated reasons, but mostly because we stopped providing supplies and ammunition we took away 17,000 outside contractors responsible for maintenance of aircraft and equipment and recon. There are other reasons, corruption. The Doha Agreement by President Trump undermined morale and undermined the government. But it wasn't lack of courage. 25 Afghans fought and died for every single American. The third myth is that Afghanistan's president and its key military leaders fled and betrayed their country by fleeing. I would ask you to think back. I don't know if any of you saw the PBS series about the Queen of Norway in the Princess of Norway in the United States and the King of Norway in Britain during World War II. Did we heap scorn on the governments of Netherlands and Norway and Belgium and others when they fled their country with the crown jewels after Hitler's invasion? Former Vice President and Marshal Bostrom fled Afghanistan at least twice before he returned to fight the Taliban from exile. So that, you know, the fleeing and living to fight another day is something that they're familiar with. Finally, do you blame President Ghani? The last time Afghanistan fell to the Taliban, they dragged the president out of his UN compound, they murdered him, and they hung his body from a lamppost. The fourth myth, because the United States invaded, 170,000 people died. Yes, probably slightly over 170,000 people now have died over the last 20 years in Afghanistan. That's civilians, Afghan military and police, NATO, and U.S. contractors and U.S. Troops. But during the 10 years before 9/11, mostly under the Taliban, 400,000 civilians alone died, many from deliberate starvation. That's not to mention the hundreds of thousands of military deaths. During the 9-year Soviet-backed government that preceded the Taliban, at least 500,000 people died. Some estimates say up to 2 million people died in those 9 years. So compare that those numbers. 170,000 died in 20 years since 9/11. Somewhere between 500,000 and 2 million died during the 9 years when the Soviet-backed government was in charge, and almost that bad when the Taliban was in charge for 9 years, for 10 years. The fifth one, I mean, it's obvious. It is time to end the war. I agree. Unfortunately, the war and the suffering won't end just because we leave, and Gilda pointed that out. It's probably going to get worse. I've been told not to talk about the last one, but I will say it's not true that every foreign army that fights in Afghanistan is doomed to defeat. The Persians ruled Afghanistan for 160 years. Alexander the Great and his Macedonians and their descendants ruled in through the Seleucid Empire for 200 years. The Mongols and then Genghis Khan's descendants, Tamerlane and Babur, ruled for almost 400 years, right up to the time when the Europeans started coming to the area. I suspect that Afghanistan has been ruled by empires and outside forces for longer than it's been independent. Now, I want to talk about a couple misconceptions. It's been said by many that the United States generals said we were winning the war and they lied. It's a little more nuanced than that, in my opinion. There's some truth to it, but I think it's a little bit overblown. We have a can-do, mission-oriented military leadership culture. I've led troops before, and hey, you're failing. The strategy is all wrong. And then expect them to accomplish the mission. Another misconception is that we lost because the Afghanistan government was corrupt. You know, impoverished nations with major inequality are going to have corruption. Duh, get over it. You have to work around it. We didn't culture of corruption, but you have to work with it. And then finally, you know, we achieved nothing in Afghanistan. Of course, this is tragically true in one sense, because so many of our accomplishments will now be undone. But despite the war and the deaths, life expectancy in Afghanistan improved by 7 years. Afghan children now can read. The literacy rate more than doubled. Almost no girls were literate under the Taliban. Now 1/3 can read and write. Health outcomes improve wildly with hospitals and medical clinics and people who learn, who are staff, who are trained. We helped build an Afghan military that took over the war beginning in Obama's last term. And the government controlled all but two of Afghanistan's provinces for 8-9 years. And of course, the biggest one, we ended the use of Afghanistan as a safe place for Al-Qaeda to plot terrorist attacks on our homeland. Bin Laden and the other architects of the 9/11 attacks were killed or captured. Well, that's enough. I think it's time now to go to questions. Again, limit your questions to 1 minute. If you didn't put a question into the chat, we can just raise your hand and we'll call upon you. Thank you.
We have two questions in chat and one raised hand right now. The first chat question is, why wasn't a withdrawal plan in place 10 years ago?
Okay, I'll address that. I think that's a good question. And I'm sure there was. I mean, they probably had half a dozen withdrawal plans. They probably had one 5 years ago too. But things change. I think it was Mike Tyson who said, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. Or a little more subtly, military strategist Sun Tzu said, no plan survives first contact with the enemy. I would want to know if they conducted, and I don't know the answer, they conducted any exercises to put the plan in place, or at least tabletop exercises or war gaming. Those can often help, but I don't know the answer.
We have one more question in the chat, and then I see John Barry's hand is raised. Question is, how much of this was due to cultural ignorance of Afghanistan combined with the military hubris over real diplomacy?
Jilda, did you want to talk to that?
Sure, I'll give that. So one of the things that I've noticed, because I actually have followed our war in Afghanistan since its beginning, and it's actually never been far from my mind, but I was just speaking with a scholar, a woman who specializes in the nonviolent movement of Afghanistan. Many people might not know this, but there was a nonviolent movement to get the British out of, it wasn't even called Afghanistan then. It was called the Northwestern Frontier. And there was a gentleman named Bacha Khan, who was Gandhi's friend. They were very, very close. And he organized thousands of Pashtun men to resist the Brits. They were nonviolent warriors. They made a commitment that they specialized in sabotage, but they made a commitment that they wanted to show that they wouldn't harm anyone, but they wouldn't be ruled by a foreign presence. And this, unfortunately, this history has really been lost, and in not casually, it's actually illegal in Pakistan to mention Bacha Khan's name. And so people are a little nervous. He paid a big price for promoting nonviolence in Afghanistan, Pakistan area. I think he was trying to create a Pashtun land for his people, who were some of the people that were most notorious. The British spoke of the Pashtuns as being very violent, very barbarous people, like you'd never want to betray them. And they surprised the world by saying, no, we are not barbarous, we are not animals, but we will resist you and you will never rule us. And that greatly appealed to those people. And so my organization and other people who know of this history are trying to help people know of it more, because I think it has a seed of hope. Those people were actually very much for women's rights. They didn't want to keep women at home. They wanted women to participate also in their liberation movement. So that gives me some hope that I wanted to share with you. But talking about that Americans weren't very culturally sensitive, the scholar that I was speaking to speaks Pashtun, and she was trying to improve her language skills. She's literate, but she wanted to learn to read and write it a bit better. And she looked for places in the United States where she could do that. And she really struggled there. Not even You know, she really couldn't find anywhere in the U.S. that had a good knowledge of Pashtun language. Now, this is just to give you an example that if we can't speak the language of the locals, how far are we really going to get in communicating with them? And so it makes me wonder, you know, if we really had the skills and the people to do what we needed to do. And what Frank had said about the hubris of the military, well, it kind of, we have this can-do attitude in the United States. And, you know, gosh darn it, the military will definitely get it done. But I think it's a little unfair to our military service to ask them to do the impossible. And it's very hard for folks to say, you know, this isn't really working, when the only response you'll probably get in return is make it work. So I hope this answered your question a little bit. And I'd like to give Frank or somebody else an opportunity to try and answer it.
Sure. I think that was very, very well said. I think it's very, very true. Very few Americans speak the major Afghan languages or understand the culture. About 2-3 years ago, a friend of mine spoke at Sharp. He was my roommate at West Point, his former military major general who had been in charge of the U.S. Army troops in Afghanistan in 2004. And he said, yeah, we don't understand the culture. We have a hard time, you know, wrapping our heads around it. And it's very difficult, very, very difficult. But we talked about military hubris over real diplomacy. One constant critique that I hear is that we could have negotiated a deal with the Taliban under Bush II, you know, right after we did the invasion while we had the upper hand. I've heard all other people say, you know, immediately after or during the Obama surge, again, we were on the offensive. They might have been willing to you know, engage in some real diplomacy then. I frankly don't know. I don't know the capacity of the Taliban for that. They didn't see to have any diplomatic skills when they were in power. So it's hard to say, but it's a good question.
I see John Barry has his hand up. Go ahead.
My question is for the two of you speakers. Thank you for preparing and doing this talk. Do the two of you feel the same way about our having gone into Afghanistan? Are you both in favor of our country's decision to go in? And if you were in favor of that, what would you have done, if anything, differently to secure a different outcome? And thirdly, what would you do if a like situation arises in some other kind of situation? Or maybe, again, it'll arise in Afghanistan. And would you recommend repeating this kind of intervention, even though it costs a lot of lives and money? Thanks.
I'd like to go first, Frank.
Go ahead.
Both of you.
Okay. So I was never in favor of the invasion of Afghanistan, which made me pretty unpopular back in 2001. I was, you know, I was in favor of doing something that would prevent another attack on us, but I was familiar with the history of the Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan, of, you know, the British Empire's work in Afghanistan. And I knew that this is the place that it's a very difficult place to rule, to try to rule. That really the only people who should be ruling Afghanistan are the people of Afghanistan. And so, I mean, we went, we used all our military might. We used, we said that we were going to help develop the country so that it would be stabler and, you know, that we could count on not being a haven for terrorists again. And we did that for 20 years. And do we honestly feel that we've made the world any safer right now? Afghanistan also has problems that it is a large supplier of heroin to the world. It grows poppies quite a bit. And so there's a criminal element. There is this, you know, this warlord element that's developed, you know, for decades, because these people are used to being invaded and having others trying to tell them what to do. And I just don't think it's really possible. I think the only hope for Afghanistan is to work preferably with women, but also with any folks who are willing to do social improvement. I mean, in a way, it would be extraordinary if the Taliban were to lay down their guns now. There are no invaders. So, you know, they could just focus on building their society. That is not what I expect to happen. And so we need to look for the people who really care about the people of Afghanistan and support them, and not just, like, you know, throw our support behind whoever is the most popular warlord of the day, because that is what gets us in trouble, not only in Afghanistan, but worldwide. I wouldn't go back if we were told to go back.
Yeah, I don't know. I think going back is not going to happen, and it probably should not happen, even if we see hundreds of thousands of people killed, which is a real possibility. Certainly it happened when the Taliban was in charge last time. To answer Jack's first question, should we have invaded the country in the first place? Well, you know, it wasn't inevitable. The Bush administration did offer the Taliban government an option. They said, you know, turn over bin Laden and the other folks who killed 3,000 Americans. And they said no. And then they dithered a little bit, and then Bush cut off communication and invaded. Where exactly that they should have said, okay, we accomplished the mission? That's a good question. I'm going to put up another screen here. There are a bunch of different theories. These are only about half of them about what happened. I don't think nation building is impossible, but as Jilda pointed out, this is a very difficult country to rule in, or for America to fight in. It's a big country. There are 70 million people. The terrain is incredible. It's really primitive. The people are uneducated. So, you know, if you're going to do nation building, it's very difficult. But I don't think it's impossible. The one of all these that I think is very true is this one right here. We set deadlines without conditions. Obama did that a little bit. Trump very definitely through the Doha agreement said, we will get out and you guys have to do this stuff, but we don't really care. And we conducted that agreement. And so, you know, we're going to be out by May of 2021 without any conditions. They didn't have to pass any deadlines. They didn't have to get anything done. So I think that was a mistake. It's mostly Trump's mistake. Biden followed through with it. Obama also set some deadlines for reducing troop levels without setting conditions. I mean, you're bargaining against yourself. I think I've said enough here.
Anyone else have questions? You can use the raise hand, or you can put them in the chat room.
Okay, if there are no questions, I'm going to ask Jill a question. So what would people in Afghanistan do physically to get the Taliban to moderate their ways?
That's a good question, because they're armed, and they obviously show that they really don't care. You know, whoever is considered, you know, breaking the law in their mind, they're quick to eliminate. So the people of Afghanistan are in a really bad situation. The best that they perhaps can do is to kind of come up with an alternative way of living that somehow that they can block the Taliban from destroying. And I'm not saying that that's easy. And I'm not saying that that's not full of risk, but somehow they need to keep educating their people. And I understand that right now, on top of everything, the poor people of Afghanistan are dealing with significant droughts. And there's a lot of food that needs to be harvested that is, you know, people are afraid to go and work in their fields. 80% of Afghanistan depends on agriculture for their livelihood. And all of this insanity is keeping them from doing the work that they need to do to take care of themselves. So perhaps the most, you know, the immediate thing that they need to do is find a way to keep living, to keep feeding themselves, to somehow keep their education going, and to kind of perhaps come up with an alternative secret government, for lack of word, but somehow to organize themselves, because now the Taliban are the ones that they need to resist. The Taliban are forcing themselves on them, calling themselves the legitimate state. And I don't think the people of Afghanistan had any say in it. And if we, you know, what we've seen in the last couple of weeks of people trying to evacuate Afghanistan, I don't think they think that, you know, they're legitimate and that there's much hope. But, you know, it's going to take a while for us to see exactly what the Taliban are going to do. And I imagine there are women who have come out into the streets to protest. That's incredibly brave. But protest is not the only option of nonviolent response. And actually, sometimes just building an alternative system that would keep people from not being completely dependent on the Taliban for their livelihoods, for their government, that might be their best way to go around resisting the Taliban. But that's the, you know, what comes to my mind. I would definitely defer to people who are from Afghanistan or whose families are from Afghanistan and see if they have any ideas. But everybody that I've spoken to at the moment isn't even thinking that far ahead. Right now, they're just focusing on getting as many people as they can out of harm's way. And or if they're fortunately lucky enough to be out of the country, to not be returned. So I don't know if that helps your answers your question, Frank, but
yeah,
that's what I can come up with.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Sally has a hand up. It was difficult to see it with your background there.
Yeah. I've heard a lot of people talking about the fact that the U.S. does actually have leverage on the Taliban, primarily economic leverage, that we've frozen assets, as has a lot of Western countries. They desperately need capital and all that sort of stuff. Therefore, there is some leverage that can perhaps moderate their positions. Is that wishful thinking, or do you think that's legitimate? And a corollary is that a lot of diplomacy kind of assumes that you view things logically and reasonably, and I'm not sure that religious zealots, by definition, are not viewing the world logically and reasonably, and therefore are all these assumptions pretty much moot.
I think it's difficult to answer that question because I'm not sure we really know. If our cultural ignorance of Afghanistan applies during wartime, it also applies to a Taliban government. Again, several people have made that, several experts have made that point. Certainly they need money. They're going to be, I can see starvation ahead this winter if they don't get assistance. Not to mention they're dealing with COVID and climate change. It would make sense that they might moderate their positions on some things or at least attempt to look like they're moderating their positions in exchange for some of the benefits that the international community can give them. But, how reasonable are they? I don't know. It's a good question and one that's kind of unknowable, but I think we're going to try. On the other hand, you know, it's difficult to say, oh, you know, you just kicked us out of Afghanistan. Now we're going to give you billions of dollars. So there's some internal political difficulties with that too, but I still think we have to try. Tilda?
So I've heard that the Taliban actually has quite a bit of money. Yes, can you hear me? My internet connection might be a little unstable.
Yeah.
Well, I'll give it a go. So I've heard that the Taliban actually has quite a bit of money. They have taxed everything that's under their power. Nothing that comes to Afghanistan is not, you know, is beyond their reach. They get a cut of everything. And you have to remember that there's a lot of drug money that reaches the Taliban.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that the United States will not pour more money into the into the Taliban's hands. I would hope that the United States would give funding to more reliable sources that actually might reach people who need support. And I think, you know, I've heard that the Taliban could turn to other governments such as Russia or China or other large players who might want to have some control. You know, don't forget that there are pipelines and other resources that people wanted built through Afghanistan. So there are interests in getting the Taliban to work with governments who may not have such an interest in human rights as the United States aims to have. So I would definitely keep watching folks who speak on behalf of women in Afghanistan. I think they'll be one of the best indicators of like what's really going on, because they're going to feel the brunt of the new government that is trying to form.
There's another question in the chat room. What can the U.S. do to get the remaining U.S. citizens or supporters out?
I was just going to say that the U.S. should continue to push, and actually not just the U.S. I mean, I think the whole world is watching this. So, you know, the U.S. in developing its, with its key partners and allies, calling for allowing people to leave, those who want to leave, to continue to do so. So for people pushing their governments around the world to pay attention to these people and giving them the opportunity to leave if they want to, I don't think anybody, and obviously they're working on getting all U.S. citizens outside, out of Afghanistan if they haven't already. I think the last plane left yesterday, the one that was controlled by the U.S., and now it's going to be interesting to see who actually succeeds in getting out of Afghanistan now, because I understand that the deadline was today.
Yep. The last flight was today. I honestly have to bang off on this question. I'm not sure I know what the answer is.
Are there any more questions?
Okay, why don't we go to statements? Anybody want to have their say?
So I see that there's actually a question that was posted, and I think it's because you don't have a mic. Sorry, everyone. Nathan actually and I are sharing the same room. Very COVID sort of thing. But I will answer first that someone put in the chat box. Gilda, what are some of the global implications that you had referred to? Global implications. Well, there's probably definitely going to become a lot more instability in that region. And there will be Afghan refugees all over the globe. But definitely I'm imagining quite a few around the neighbors of Afghanistan. And I'm imagining quite a few to Europe. And the lucky ones, you know, some will be able to come to the U.S. unless, you know, the United States' resistance to refugees increases, because we've seen that go back and forth. But, you know, I think there will be more heroin on the market, because that will be one way of also bringing more income into the U.S., into Afghanistan, I'm sorry, and to Taliban. And it takes less water to grow poppies than it does to grow fruit and melons. So it's cheaper to produce and you get more money for it. So, yeah, I don't think we even fully know all the implications that are going to happen with this state going to the Taliban and going in this direction. So I hope I answered your question a bit.
I was saying I agree with everything you said. We're conceivably talking about many hundreds of thousands, perhaps million for refugees over time. That could have some instability impacts on Pakistan, on Iraq, on Iran, rather, on Uzbekistan, the Tajiks. And yeah, ultimately many of those refugees are going to want to go to Turkey or to Europe. And I think that, you know, the United States has to be generous. Both our government and our NGOs need to support those people. And I, I want to say something for, you know, the Trump administration completely botched giving visas to interpreters and drivers and other people who would work with the U.S. government and our military. In some cases, they took 6 years to process an application. I won't say that, you know, Biden administration was great, but they only had 6 months. It's really a real tragedy, but that's one thing they definitely could have done differently and done better. And now there's a legitimate concern. You have to say, okay, some of these people could be terrorists. It's possible. And they might infiltrate. So fine, you bring them to Guam, or you bring them to an Air Force base in Washington State or Alabama or wherever, and you process them and do your job. Now the concern had to be on getting people out. And now that there are people out, you know, I personally would like to get involved with the folks in the diaspora to see how we can help. Obviously, you know, people can help with money, but maybe there are other ways too. I understand there was a call for furniture the other day, for example.
That organization, Roots for Peace, Shilda, I think they were part of one of the World Affairs Council forums, right? And I'm not sure how they're planning to do it with the Taliban in charge, but they are asking people to give money so that they can support agriculture.
Mm-hmm. So there is a program called Roots for Peace. It'll be we're going to share a document afterwards in the email that we'll be sending out after this call. There'll be a list of resources. There'll be the list of folks that I met with when I was at the virtual town hall. And there are people who are asking for money, but there are also people who are looking for folks who can sponsor refugees to help them come over. So if people are involved with a church or a school or some other kind of organization, you might be able to sponsor someone and help them get out of Afghanistan, or at least not have to return to it. There's a lot of different things that folks can do. But yes, I mean, even by supporting your Afghan neighbors, and actually, because this isn't going to disappear overnight. This is going to be with us for many, many years. And I guess the most encouraging thing I can tell you is to just stick, you know, pay attention, stick with it, and, you know, try to inform yourself as best as you can of what's going on. That's really what it's going to take to help the people of Afghanistan.
And I agree with Frank in the sense that, you know, if we are going to take in, you know, possibly massive amounts of refugees, you know, besides vetting people, there should be some sort of campaign to Americanize them, perhaps, you know, because oftentimes, even if the people who come over here, you know, are on our side, their children may get radicalized or something. So I think it's not just a matter of taking in refugees, but having that, you know, campaign, right? And sort of public campaign around Afghanistan, you know, when the United States was, you know, in Cold War with the Soviet Union, where I happened to be born, right? There was a lot of, frankly, propaganda against the Soviet Union, right? We also heard dissidents speak. I mean, propaganda in the good kind of sense. And I'm not so sure if we, you know, maybe I've been missing it, but I'm not so sure if we, you know, heard a lot of people from Afghanistan speak over the years. I'm not so sure where they are. You know, why are they not part of, you know, kind of being consulted, you know, consulting our government, appearing on TV? You know, why we're not doing this kind of massive campaign against the Taliban. One of the reports was that they are actually doing, you know, sort of underhanded things like going to places outside of city and forcibly marrying girls to Taliban fighters. So those kinds of things were, you know, again, not just exposed, but trumpeted all over the world. These are the kind of people that are doing this, you know. This is what's happening. This is outrageous, you know. So I think, again, just kind of getting, you know, I don't think there's been a lot, you know, kind of consistent PR on the subject. Because otherwise, how can we influence things, you know, if not through military or through some sort of pressure? I mean, definitely putting pressure on them economically, any old way, or the countries that our players, like Jibla says, you know, kind of exposing what's going on. Myself, I'm not sure. I think there still should be some sort of maybe backup military presence or something from the United States, or maybe from other countries. Because again, if they just start massacring people, I'm not sure how we can stand by and say, well, we were there for 20 years, but now we're allowing this to happen.
I want to speak to one of the points that you made, Nathan, and that's integrating refugees into society. Germany has actually done has had a very active program for integrating mostly Syrian refugees, and the, you know, the in terms of getting them jobs, doing job counseling, education, language training, social connecting them to social services, providing housing to start with. And the United States had not been as strong on that kind of program, and some other countries have been worse, of course. But that's a good point.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think we're going to, though, face a lot of backlash now from, you know, conservatively minded people who will say, well, we're not doing so well. You know, a lot of our people aren't doing well. Our economy is not doing well. There's a lot of, frankly, you know, pissed off poor white people that will say, well, you're taking in those refugees and you're providing with these services. What about us? So, gosh, you know, it's going to, again, there's going to have to be a lot of sort of careful PR and finding the right counterstatements to the kind of stuff that's going to appear on, in, you know, in conservative media to say, look at what they're doing to our country. You know, they went in and now they're letting refugees in, you know, and just to recognize, well, you know, again, partly this is true. We didn't help them and now we're kind of taking them in. We're going to have to do this. You know, we're going to have to really think this through, because otherwise it's going to give, frankly, it's going to destabilize the country in one more way. It's going to give, you know, folks reasons to you know, elect more and make more sort of policies that, you know, that will use this as sort of a way to elect more dictatorially minded people, no names mentioned. So, you know, to say, well, our country's under attack again, you know, so this is not going to be easy.
We have another question in the chat. If you want to take that, Frank, John Barry.
Sure. John writes, my thought is that women in Islamic Afghanistan have no voice, no rights, and that heroin money rules the show. I think we were right to go in, but we should not have partnered with a crook that was running the country. If China had been in there instead of us, the result would have been opposite. So there's three or four different ideas in here. I definitely think the Taliban obviously degrades women and has a completely different view than most people in the West. If China had been there instead of us, well, you know, the Chinese did have some made contracts with the Chinese government, with the Afghan government, to develop some mining interests in Afghanistan, because Afghanistan apparently is mineral rich, and now they've already made links with the Taliban to see how they can exploit that and avoid getting bombed like they were before. So I do think you're going to see, you know, the Taliban's always, pardon me, the Chinese government is always happy to thumb their noses at the American government. So they'll probably be very happy to see if they can talk to the Taliban. On the other hand, you know, China has its own concern with folks in the western part of their country who are Muslim, and they've kept their very tight reins, almost akin to slavery, with the Uyghurs. And it'll be interesting to see if the Taliban cares about that at all, or they don't care about their fellow religionists, and they're mostly in it for their own financial benefit. So, Jola, did you have anything to add?
No, I think, Frank, that you're right. China doesn't have a great record in human rights, and a country that I've actually been working for and more closely is South Sudan. One of the very poor, very violent, going through a civil wars, the most recent one since 2013. And China really hasn't done anything to influence, to stop the war, the civil war in that country. As long as they get the oil that they want, they pretty much let, you know, the South Sudanese fight and kill each other and do incredible human rights violations, particularly to women and children. So, you know, China's not going to improve quality of life in Afghanistan. I would doubt that very much. So as long as they get, you know, the resources or whatever their interests are, they'll pretty much would allow, I think, the Taliban to do what they want. And I don't know, you know, China hasn't chosen to invade Afghanistan. I guess they weren't attacked from Afghanistan the way our country was, but I can't envision a military solution in Afghanistan. It's just, you know, no one's, you can't, that terrain, those people, they'll never be ruled by another place. And just as they have resisted being ruled by outsiders, the best chance is to take that resistance and apply it towards and against the Taliban. And I think our best partners in trying to improve life in Afghanistan will be the women. Even though they are more the most at risk and they have the most to lose, they're half the population. So, you know, by somehow supporting them and what they think are realistic goals that they accomplish, it may not happen overnight. It may not happen in 10 years, but it would be a step in the right direction of actually trying to bring some kind of stability, some kind of improved life to that part of the world.
Okay.
I'm not sure how. Oh, I'm sorry. Somebody has another thought.
Something else. Yeah, there's a question in the in the chat room for you, Jilda. Do you want to address that?
Sure. So the reason I was invited to speak is because I work for an international organization known as Nonviolent Peace Force, and their focus is on the protection of civilians, and they are not political. We are focused on nonviolence. We work in conflict zones around the world, and we do not take sides because we keep pointing that we're not getting tied up in political questions. What we're concerned about is the safety and well-being of civilians, and we keep bringing that to the forefront and trying to help civilians become involved in their own peace process and in their own security, because that is ultimately what's going to lead to peace, is actually a safer community, a safer world. So that's my bio, and I'm happy to, after this call, if people still have more questions about this work, I'm happy to share it with you. But I want to stay focused on Afghanistan because that's what we promised that we would talk about during this call.
Great. Anybody else have anything they want to say or any questions to ask?
Again, I'm not sure how it's going to be done, but I think one of the tragedies, again, we don't really have a lot of contact with people from Afghanistan. We have no links. Jilda mentioned Badshah Khan. I think, didn't he come from the warrior class, Jilda? And for the lay person, again, this is a little bit of history that there was a, do you want to repeat that again? Or?
Okay. So, yes, there is a tradition in Afghanistan, mostly to the Pashtuns, but they are known as a warrior people, but they were able to resist the British actually without fighting. Thousands of them organized in efforts of sabotage and just coming up with a different system so that they weren't ruled by the British. So anybody who's interested in knowing a bit more about that history, I'm happy to share that with you.
And I think, again, I mean, it's like if there's any way of organizing some sort of public campaign about that, about the history of Afghanistan, about trying to communicate a different image of Afghanistan to the world in a way that the Afghan people can participate in, that there's no such, you know, no disconnect. Again, when we were, you know, at sort of at war, in Cold War with Russia, there was a lot of you know, people were trying to present dissidents and alternative visions of resistance in Russia to what was going on. We don't really see that much, I think, again, in the case of Afghanistan, right? We're not talking that much about the women activists that are trying to resist this, or, you know, writers from Afghanistan or anybody like that, so that perhaps there may be a link. You know, what the Taliban want to do is just completely cut off ties, right? Anybody who had any relations with anybody will just get killed. And that way, nobody will really know what's going on there. If you do have connections with a country, there are consequences. There have been, you know, shysters and criminals who have kind of made buddies here from Russia or from China. And, you know, and they do use this government to for their own monetary purposes. But I think it's still not as bad as having no connections and then you don't know what's going on, you know, and the Taliban are the only ones who know, like North Korea or something like that. And, you know, that's a far more dangerous situation than people who do want to cooperate, albeit not for very good reasons. At least you have a connection to that country, right? A China that is interested in our business is still, you know, a little, you know, less scary than the one who does not want us in at all and does not want us and does not allow us to see what's happening in the country at all, like Kim Jong-un, you know.
Well, it seems there's no more questions in the chat room. Frank and Jyoti, do you have any closing comments?
No, I think we've, I don't want to say we've said it all, but we've enjoyed hearing your questions and responding. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I do hope that we've helped you at least get at least more information about Afghanistan. And I'm hoping that the document that we'll be sharing with you in the email after this call will help you feel like you have somewhere to turn or some folks you can turn to for more questions. If not, you know, feel free to contact me and I'll try to help you find what you're looking for or maybe find someone who can answer your questions probably with a little bit more depth or experience than I. But once again, I really appreciate you taking the time and I appreciate being with all my neighbors. And I'm really proud to be part of a neighborhood that cares and is looking out for others, looking out for one another in our own neighborhood and also seeing the world as something to care for and a larger neighborhood, let's put it. So thanks, everyone.
We're going to put, Frank and Jyoti are going to give me some links, which I'm going to put on the Sharp website. So that will be under meetings and then sort of a subheading of past meetings. And you'll find their recap of today's meeting, a full audio recording of this meeting, and then the links that Jyoti and Frank give me. So that's on the Sharp webpage. That'll be up in a couple days. Jyoti and Frank, thank you very much.